And our next item is our director's report. Director Anderson?
Just wanted to make a couple remarks relative to the public testimony we heard today.
Okay.
First to Mr. Rue's issue with smelt on the north end of Camino Island. I would like to ask if you could check in with Jim Scott there and make sure that we have your contact information. I'd like to have Jim have a conversation with you, and I will check in with Jim to try to address the issue that you brought forward. Mr. Barnes brought forward the hoof rot issue, and we're going to get a pretty comprehensive briefing tomorrow on that topic. And so discussion about what we're doing, the science involved, the next steps, we'll have an opportunity to talk about that in greater detail tomorrow. And then Ron Gardner, certainly echo the compliments that were made relative to Ron's leadership in the groundfish world, you know, halibut world. The descender device issue really started to take off in California first. There's been considerable work done by the Scientific and Statistical Committee of the Pacific Fishery Management Council looking at, I mean, just because you send them down and they disappear, you can't conclude that what happened to those fish. Did they survive or not? And what's the long-term mortality piece associated with being caught at relatively deep water depths and being brought to the surface and then returned to depth? So there is a fair amount of work that's been going on. I would like to have probably Michelle Culver and Heather Reed come and give you a presentation of some of the work that's been done and some of the briefings that we've received at the Pacific Fishery Management Council table, because it is not going to get us back to a point where we're going to be retaining yellow-eye rockfish anytime soon. We're in a long-term rebuilding plan for species like yellow-eye rockfish and canary rockfish. But it can, I believe, from all the information I've looked at, help reduce the mortalities that are associated with a catch and release while you're targeting on other species. And that, in turn, has the potential, at least, of reducing the number of restrictions that we have to place on fisheries that are targeting on healthy stocks. And I'd like to have an opportunity to bring that some of that information to the commission. On the ling cod problem, I remember when I came onto the Pacific Council in 1988, if I had a personal interest that I was bringing to that job, it was to get the trawlers off our rocky reef habitat off the coast of Washington, where had developed truck tire gear, where they were literally using large truck tires on their foot ropes that allowed them to go into really rocky reef habitat, and they were catching 60,000-70,000 pounds of ling cod a delivery. And ling cod was later to be determined to be overfished. There was a rebuilding program put in place, and within a 10-year time frame, ling cod have been rebuilt, and they're healthy, and there's some extraordinary ling cod recreational fisheries going on from Westport to La Push to Nia Bay. I like that problem. I'll take that problem, and I'm sorry you're having to weed through those to get to your halibut, but for those 5 days that halibut were open, but I'll send you a sympathy card for that. There are some, I think the other thing that Ron spoke to is some of the innovations that there are relative to gear that he talked about, where we're enabling anglers to target on more midwater types of pelagic species of rockfish like yellowtail rockfish through gear innovation, keeping the hooks off the bottom, those kinds of things hold a lot of promise, I think, for us. And he mentioned the Descender device called the Sequalizer. It's a pretty cool tool. I've got one. And again, you can set that to depth so it will go down, and you don't have to try to keep track of how far you're letting your line down before you let that rockfish go. It does it for you. So there's some really great stuff going on, and for an organization like Puget Sound Anglers to grab a hold of this and really help in terms of not only getting the word out, but making sure everybody's got one, they're accessible, is really an extraordinary thing that they've done. So just kudos to them, and thanks for working closely with Heather and Michelle on that.
Great, thanks. Thanks for responding to the various public comments that we heard. Okay, the director's report now.
I'm going to do it from the table here.
A PowerPoint? So have you convinced Joe that this is a good idea, this PowerPoint approach?
So I'm going to, I have my presentation broken into four parts. A little bit of information about some outreach and public education work that the department's been doing. I wanted to talk about Columbia River policy implementation. Talk a little bit about our work in terms of implementing our wolf conservation and management plan. And then my fourth category is the catch-all of a variety of short topics. Well, I don't know about you, but it seems like it's been longer than 2 months since we were together. Been a really busy time for the department, and it just seems like it's been quite a while since we've been together. So my report, part of the director's report, is going to occupy most of our time that's allotted to that, and I'll try to not run over. Wanted to talk a little bit about our what's been going on within our public affairs community outreach group, and it's broader than that. There's been a lot of work done on that Bruce Botka has been doing in terms of coordinating with the programs, and there's been a lot of agency staff involved in a number of different activities, and over the course of the last 3 or 4 months that have been promoting fish and wildlife activities. My first category is local events and social media. We do, as you, I believe you know, have a new community outreach coordinator. His name is Jason Wetstein. He's using social media to promote the department's support for kids fishing and hunting events and local community festivals. The effort is building a lot of goodwill for the department across the state as we work with sponsoring organizations to promote their events. It's also a great way to emphasize non-consumptive recreational opportunities along with our traditional fishing and hunting activities. Some examples of the events that we've played a part in promoting recently, and there's in Federal Way, the 26th annual Hooked on Fishing event with Puget Sound Anglers was one. We had a Clear Lake Kids Fishing Day up in Skagit County, Shorebird Festival in Grace Harbor there toward the first weekend of May or last weekend of April. Over in Leavenworth, the Spring Birds Fest. In Squim, a kids fishing day that again was done in partnership with Puget Sound Anglers. Bogoshiel River, a kids fishing day. Longview, we had Lake Sacagawea Kids Fishing Event. Over in Grace Harbor County, a youth hunter workshop with the Waterfowl Association. Over in Kennewick, Columbia Park Pond, a Kennewick Fishing Event. There in Montesano, Lake Sylvia Kids Fishing Event, and in Walla Walla Kids Fishing Event with the Tri-State Steelheaders. So those are some examples of work that we've been doing, trying to partner with organizations, nonprofit organizations that are out there doing really good work and trying to help where we can in promoting those different types of activities. And you probably noticed that there was a big emphasis on getting youth involved in those activities. We also use our Facebook and Twitter posts. They're received by more than 10,000 people per week, and we can track the number of people who see information about specific events so we can get a sense of where the interests are. We had more than 1,500 people saw our information about our kids fishing event at Lake Merwin in Clark County, and about 1,000 saw our promotion of the youth hunting workshop that we held in Grace Harbor County, just as an example of going in and looking at how effective and how many contacts that we can have in terms of educating the public on where these events are and what they're focused on. We've had some stops and starts in terms of our participation in participating in different kinds of sports shows. So we went through from 2007, where we had our really first big budget hit of the $20+ million. That was an area that we said that we were going to reduce and cut out. I don't know whether that was a good decision or not. If I had to make it again, whether I would make the same decision or not. But there was a lot of interest by department staff saying, you know, that really, those shows really give us an opportunity to interact with our constituents. The money that we invest into participating in those shows pays big dividends from our perspective in terms of having an opportunity to interact with our customers. And so there was some creep in that some of the staff members that were really had long time participation, and some of those said, we want to do this. And so we had a pretty lively discussion about having a more coordinated, organized way of participating in sport groups within our executive management team over the course of the fall and winter. And so we made decisions on what sport shows we were going to participate in. And we also wanted to evaluate the benefits of those to the extent of a lot of it's qualitative evaluation of benefits. But our regional directors, each one where the individual events were being held, were asked to be responsible for evaluating and providing information into Bruce Botka on those shows so that we could have an understanding at the end of this kind of show season, which is late December through the end of March, first part of middle of April time frame. What did we learn? What can we do better? Where should we be standardized in terms of the things that we're doing at those shows? And obviously, we want to make sure that we give flexibility to the regions to tailor the information that they have at those shows to the area. So we just recently completed that evaluation of our participation in the sport shows. Fish and Wildlife staff made personal contact with over 6,000 of our core customers as part of these shows. And all of the regional directors felt that the benefits more than justify the costs. The public affairs and outreach staff worked with personnel from each program and region on at least one show in each region. The Spokane Bighorn Show, the Wenatchee Valley Sportsman Show, the Central Washington Sportsman Show that's in Yakima, Tri-City Sportsman Show that is in Pasco, Seattle Boat Show, the Washington Sportsman Show, which is in Puyallup, and then the Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show in Portland were the ones that our public affairs and outreach staff linked up and worked on with the regional staff. I've got a pretty comprehensive evaluation report that Joe and I received and had a chance to review with Bruce Botka yesterday. I'd be happy to provide that to you if you'd like to see it. It's a pretty big spreadsheet. We can get that to you here before the day's out. And it's going to help us in terms of planning for our 2014 shows. We want to improve our messaging and staffing patterns in coordination with our enforcement programs, TIP trailer, which are all, in many cases, are on site in some of these programs or some of these shows, and want to make sure, and it's a real popular item as well. Again, sticking with our public affairs and outreach group, you may be aware that our public disclosure coordinator is located within that group, and our public disclosure requests have increased by 20% this last year, and this year looks even busier. I was going to say worse, but I guess I should say busier. We responded to 662 disclosure requests last year, which was up from 553 in 2011. The process generates a large workload for the program and regional staff members who have to produce very, very large volumes of documents depending on the nature of the request. To give you an idea of the number of requests that come kind of by program or area of interest, our licensing, we had 158 public disclosure requests that for information come out of our licensing division. Enforcement had 148. Fish had 102. Habit had 108. Director's office 26, and the commission had 18. So just wanted you to be aware of just how big a job this is, and we've had some more recent public disclosure requests that could take as long as a year to compile all of the information that's being requested. And we may even, I'm beginning to think about and talking with Joe about the need to hire additional staff so we don't have our biologists spending all of their time responding to public disclosure requests and not actually doing the conservation and management work that they were hired to do. Switching gears now, but again in that public outreach category, we had a large presence at the recent Salmon Recovery Conference in Vancouver. It was coordinated by the Recreation and Conservation Office that's located here in the Natural Resource Building. Bruce Botka and his counterparts from several agencies, including BPA, NOAA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, discussed how to tell the salmon recovery story and translate fish and habitat science for non-experts into common language. I also had an opportunity to be a keynote speaker at the lunch at one of the days, and the theme of my talk was talking about how hatcheries, harvest, and salmon recovery efforts need to be integrated, and that the success of one is interdependent on the success of the other. And so it was a good opportunity for me to talk with them. Switching to my second primary category, which is the Columbia River Basin Salmon Management Policy Update. I know the Fish Committee had an opportunity to talk about some of this last night, so some of this will be repetitive for them. Apologize for that. The department is actively working with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to progressively implement management actions consistent with the guiding principles of the policy. The policy has been challenged in Washington courts, and the Oregon rules are subject to litigation in Oregon State. That has slowed the process, the progress of the implementation. And let me talk a little bit about why that is. Under the category of Oregon rules and litigation, their rules were adopted by their commission back in December 2012. They were challenged on a procedural and substantive grounds. The court granted Oregon's request to reopen the rulemaking process to address the perceived procedural errors raised by the plaintiffs. The court issued the order to give ODF&W the time and opportunity to issue a new notice of proposed rulemaking and a new fiscal impact statement, provide interested persons additional opportunity to comment, and reconsider whether to repeal, readopt, or amend the rules that are subject to the judicial review. The Oregon court also placed the implementation of the rules on hold. So that's an important, very, very important piece. You all know how important it is for us to have compatible and consistent regulations in the river, and for us to do something in Oregon not being able to do something and vice versa represents a real obstacle to implementing some of the provisions of the policy. Oregon has just completed the additional comment and review process, and yesterday and today their Fish and Wildlife Commission is meeting to consider adoption of the administrative rules associated with the management strategies, including the retention of white sturgeon and barbless hooks. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife hopes that when the Oregon court lifts its order placing the litigation on hold, it will also lift the stay on the implementation of the rule. Oregon's counsel estimates that it could take up to a year for the court to rule. Another important component of implementation, particularly as it relates to the alternative gear pilot, is that the Oregon legislature is in the process of considering Senate Bill 830 that has three primary elements. The first is that it repeals the prohibition of fixed gears and seines for commercial fisheries. And noting that it does not constrain the use of gill nets. So currently those alternative gears, those particularly beach seines and purse seines, which were the two gears that have been tested with some level of success up to this point in time, they're not legal in Oregon, and Oregon has no way from a rulemaking perspective to put those gears on the water. And so in terms of building a pilot program for 2013, the only way that it could be done is on Washington through our exempted fishery or emerging commercial fishery statutes. Thank you. The legislation establishes a transition fund through 2019 to aid commercial fishers during that period to avoid economic harm. And it also establishes a Columbia River Fisheries Enhancement Fund for Columbia Basin recreational anglers to help implement the management and reform framework. That Senate Bill 830 has passed out of the Senate Environmental and Natural Resources Committee, and it now sits in Ways and Means. The Oregon legislature is scheduled to conclude on June 30th. And they, too, have the ability for a special session, but only for another 2 weeks through July 13th, if that were needed. Looking at the Washington litigation, the lawsuit has been refiled. It was originally filed in Wekiakum County, but it's now been filed in Thurston County Superior Court. That complaint alleges that the commission's January 12, 2013 adoption of the policy 3620 constitutes the issuance of a regulation. They assert that the regulation is invalid and seek to have it invalidated by the court. They make a general allegation regarding the effect of the regulation and then turn to four claims in support of their claim for relief. They generally allege that the regulation reallocates ESA impacts and harvestable surplus of salmon, thereby reducing the quantity of salmon that can be caught by commercial harvesters, and that the overall effects of the regulation is to ban gill nets on the Columbia main stem for all species of fish, including sturgeon, smelt, shad, and salmon. They have four specific claims for why the regulation should be invalidated. And they flow from this general allegation that I just referenced. The first one is that they claim the regulation violates the mandate of RCW 7704012, which is, I quote, maintain the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry, end quote. The second is they claim the regulation violates the mandate under that same statute, and I quote, enhance and improve recreational and commercial fishing in the state. The third is that they claim the commission is improperly constituted and thus incapable of making this decision. Their assertion is that RCW 7704040 requires the governor to maintain a balance of interests, and the absence of any commercial fishing interest on the commission is a fatal flaw to his decision-making authority. And the fourth one is they claim the regulation requires DFW to work with Oregon on consistent and concurrent regulations, but that given that the Oregon litigation and the stay issued for Oregon's regulations, they asked the court to stay enforcement of DFW's regulation pending the outcome of the Oregon litigation. Discussions are occurring between our Attorney General's office and the counsel for the plaintiffs. However, that the litigation is moving slowly, but though that's what's in place right now and what's in front of the court relative to the Washington litigation. Turning now to the spring Chinook fishery and the adaptive management implementation, the policy provides 65% of the allowable impacts on upriver spring Chinook stocks to be allocated to the recreational fishery. However, in Oregon, due to the stay, the recreational allocation remained at 60%. Through the Columbia River Compact, the difference in Washington and Oregon policies was resolved, as in the past year, by placing a 5% of the allowable impacts in a set-aside buffer. More recently, the Department of Fish and Wildlife exercised an adaptive management provision of the commission policy regarding the commercial spring Chinook fishery by adopting what we call a large 8-inch mesh for gillnet regulations for the last two fishing periods in May to avoid handling increasing numbers of shad and steelhead. The commercial fishery was limited to just one period in April due to limited catch opportunity associated with the smaller run size forecasts, compounded with the 40% buffer on the commercial fishery that's in place prior to the run size update. Following the May run size update, it was determined that over 50% of the commercial allocation remained, enabling additional commercial fishing opportunity. The Columbia River Compact set the first fishery, May 15th, with tangle net gear, and then the next two periods, May 22nd and May 29th, were set with large mesh gear. Why? Shad runs in the Columbia River range from 1 to 3 million fish annually, and peak abundance in the lower river is in May and early June. Managers were concerned that too many shad in a drift could compromise the ability for the fish, for the fishery that target on Chinook, while meeting the selective fishery requirements, in particular the rule to limit total drift time to 45 minutes. Significant reduction in handling of shad and steelhead with 8-inch gear, even with the increased abundances of those two species in the latter period, was achieved. Monitoring data collected by observers during the commercial fisheries, this again is in zones 1 through 5, on May 15th and then on May 22nd show several comparisons that bear out the conclusion that this was achieved. On the opening of May 15th, 44 Chinook were handled, 8 steelhead were handled, and 1,900 shad were handled. That was with tangle net. The next week, we used 8-inch gear. Chinook handled 56 compared to 44 the previous week. Steelhead handled were 0 compared to 8 the previous week. And shad handled were 6 compared with the 1,900 the previous week. So we use what we believe appropriately, the adaptive management provisions in the policy in season, to make sure that the fishery objectives were achieved, and that we used the gear that was most appropriate given the set of circumstances that presented themselves. And again, we're in this now, what I'm now, maybe this is the new norm, where we have that run crossing the dam at a later and later time frame, and having to make decisions that we used to make in the middle of April, we're now having to make those in the first 2 weeks of May, given the lateness really of the timing of that run crossing Bonneville Dam, where we can do our in-season updates. I want to now turn to the testing of alternative selective fishing gear and talk about how we're preparing for our pilot fishery using the alternative gears. Two types of alternative gear tests will be conducted this fall, and I believe both of these are essential to us moving to the next step of implementing the pilot fishery. First is survival rates of fish released from purse seines and beach seines. We've done it for 2 years. This will be the third year. There are some holes in the data we need to fill. And we also need to get the results of that study and the conclusions and recommendations about what the release mortality rates are approved through USV Oregon. That's an important step that has to be taken, in my view, before we move forward with the pilot fishery. Testing the effectiveness of other alternative gear in catching salmon is another thing that we're doing. There is a type of gear that we want to look at that is similar to a trap. And we tried it. We tried a type of trap several years ago. In addition to the purse seine and beach seine, we didn't have much success. There's another type of trap, and I had the name of it, but I can't find it. But we want to test that third type of gear to make sure that we're not overlooking any types of gear that could be effective in implementing the policy, selectively harvesting hatchery fish, and having minimal encounters with wild fish.
Is that pound net?
Yes. Pound net. Thanks, Commissioner Mankin. Implementation of the pilot alternative fishing gear. So the second provision of the policy is it directs us to investigate, I quote, investigate and promote the development and implementation of alternative selective gear during the transition period beginning in 2013. While we've done this test fishing, and we've demonstrated some success, particularly with beach seines and purse seines, the pilot commercial seine fishery is, while it's not a full scale, we're going to have more participants in it. The uncertainties around the litigation, the allocation issues that would confront us if we tried to do this in 2013, and that is to say, can't do it in Oregon. We can only do it in Washington. If we were going to do it in Washington, we would have to make an allocation decision about what portion of the ESA impacts that were allocated to the gillnet fishery would be taken away from that fishery and allocated to the pilot fishery. And because it would only be done in Washington, then it would be an allocation to the state fishers, and because the Oregon folks, and it could only be done in Washington waters, and we know that the dividing line between Oregon and Washington favors Oregon in a big way. I wish we could go renegotiate that line again. And so it, with those complications of, we have to do it through our emerging commercial fishery statute. If we're going to limit participation, we have to establish an advisory board. It would be done through the issuance of experimental permits. It could only be done in Washington waters. It would involve an allocation between the gillnet gear, which both states participate in, and the pilot fishery, which only Washington would participate in. We don't have technical agreement under USV Oregon on the release mortality rates yet, and we need this additional information that we're doing this year to get there. And that led us to the conclusion, and I will say right up front, we didn't do as good a job communicating with the commission on this as we should have, and I apologize for that. But that led us to the conclusion where we needed to focus on closing the loop on these key pieces so that when we do the pilot program, we can do it successfully and move it toward full transition and full implementation of the policy. If we tried to jam it in there this year, with all of those I will call them obstacles in front of us, I just did not see how we could be successful in implementing the pilot. The term pilot is not very well defined in terms of, well, how many does that mean? Is that 10? Is that 15? Is that 5? Is it 20? What is it? We need to work that through with that advisory group, and it needs to be coordinated with Oregon. But that doesn't mean we're not moving forward to try to close these gaps that I mentioned, both legally, and not that we have a lot to do or anything to do with what's going on in litigation in Oregon, or that we have anything to do with the Oregon legislature, but those are two key pieces, along with the release mortality rates that I mentioned, the exploration of the third gear type, and making sure that we get through the technical review of our release mortality rates are all key pieces in my mind to be successful in moving forward to the next step. All right, and I'm happy to answer questions. If you don't mind, if I can get through the balance of this, I'm going to be a little bit over my time, but Joe promised me he wouldn't take very long. So I want to move to the wolf management piece. Wanted to talk a little bit about our collaring activities over the winter, and if I can make this.
Nate, did you have something you wanted to pass along? He kind of made it halfway up here and then turned around.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, maybe I was going to hold this to the last, but I'll do it first. I think everybody's aware, I know the commission is aware that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been contemplating what to do with the listing of the Canis lupus species of gray wolves in the lower 48. And we've talked a lot about this in terms of what that means in terms of our ability to fully implement our plan. Particularly in the portion of the state that's listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. And there's been a tremendous amount of activity over the course of the last couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, on this matter, calls with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and discussions here at home. And we did have I had a call with Dan Ash, director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, yesterday afternoon, and what he shared with us yesterday that was is now represented in an article that came out from the AP that Dan provided an interview with AP yesterday. It was embargoed until 8:15 this morning. This is the first time seeing it. I'm not going to read it all, but the bottom line is the Obama administration on Friday will propose lifting most of the remaining federal protections for gray wolves across the lower 48 states, a move that would end four decades of recovery efforts, but has been criticized by some scientists as premature. It goes on to talk about the 6,100 wolves that are in the northern Rockies and western Great Lakes, and that I'm going to stop right there, not reading more. We'll get you copies of this, but that's the result of the intense discussions that went on both at the federal level as well as with the states. So everybody remembers probably that when listed, there's going to be about a year process of public comment regarding the proposed rule, and public comments could be extended, you never know. But they're starting down that path. Our message, and I'll provide you copies to this as well, has not been so much focused on whether we support or not the proposed rule. It's been more focused on that we're making good progress in Washington. We're committed to the long-term recovery here in Washington. We've got a great plan that has established objectives throughout the state, that we're going to stay the course regardless of whether or not this rule is approved or not. Our wolf plan contains tools that some of which we can't use in the western two-thirds, that if approved, this rule would allow us to use those tools, and that we believe that management is for wolves is best handled by the states. And so it's more of a proactive statement about what our vision is. We believe that social tolerance is a critical element in wolf recovery in the state of Washington, and that our plan addresses actions and provides tools to ensure help assure that social level of social tolerance is achieved. So we'll get you that information. Just wanted to provide you a summary of the collaring activities. We're not done yet, but this map shows you that since February, 10 wolves have been captured and collared on four packs, two in the Diamond Pack, three in Smackout, three in the Tianaway. One of the three died a few days later after a capture due to a cougar predation, and two in Huckleberry. And Salmo has an active collar from last year. You can see on the slide where those are. The Wenatchee pack, our most recent confirmed pack, we trapped last month without any captures. We're going to be trapping again midsummer. Our lookout pack, we're currently trapping there. We suspect we have den activity with pups for the lookout. Wedge packed, we suspect we have at least two pack members there, and trapping will commence there in midsummer as well. And the Colville tribe is currently trapping in Strawberry, and their collars that they put on animals last year are no longer functioning. Trapping plans are also underway in our new areas with recent wolf signs, such as their suspected ruby pack area. So that's just an overview of what we're doing from a trapping and collar perspective. We've also got four trapping teams that are in place, and that includes one team on standby for any emerging wolf livestock conflicts priorities. Our conflict specialists are preparing for local trapping as needed, and we're working with the Spokane tribe and Colville tribe on trapping on their reservation with tribal or contracted trappers. Also included on this map is what we're doing and how we have, are gearing up from deploying new wildlife conflict specialists. We currently have 4 wildlife conflict specialists on staff, and we've advertised for 4 new positions, and these staff are focused solely on addressing wildlife conflict issues, including wolf livestock conflict. Our current positions are located in Colville, Walla Walla, Yakima, and Ellensburg, and you can see that we're recruiting positions to expand that coverage to include Skagit County, Okanagan County, Chelan Douglas County, and Spokane County. We've had a lot of success with our wildlife conflict specialists that we've put in place. Anthony Novak comes to mind as being one that we've had in place in the Yakima, Helensburg, Kittitas area. That's, we've had a lot of success there. And so we're gearing up so that we can respond more fully across the geographic area of Washington. The other area I wanted to touch on was that of data sharing. There's been a lot of interest, and rightly so, in terms of sharing our data, particularly as relative to our caller GPS tracking with both livestock operators and county governments. And we've started sharing wolf caller data using an online tool for viewing locations, which are collected every 6 hours. The tool is intended to be used by livestock producers that meet several criteria. One is that they graze livestock on open range, that is on a public or private grazing allotment, and that the grazing overlaps with confirmed wolf pack territory with one or more active GPS callers, and the producer has signed and returned a sensitive fish and wildlife information release agreement, and that they have entered into a cost share agreement, and that the release agreement, the producer may list up to 5 members, which include members of his family, employees, or designees as authorized representatives, includes range riders and ranch hands, so that the caller data may be distributed, may be controlled in terms of who it's distributed to. Data sharing began on June 1 and continues until this winter when livestock are removed from the open range. And relative to counties or local governments, the department also intends to share data with county commissioners that request wolf caller data. And to date, data sharing agreements have been shared with over 10 counties in eastern Washington. So we're making a concerted effort with some conditions in terms of sharing our caller data with the livestock operators so that they can be informed about the location of wolves that may be interacting with their livestock as well as county officials. We have also that you were a part of in a big way in terms of the implementation of the emergency rule relative to allowing an individual to lethally remove a wolf that was caught in the act of attacking a domestic animal, which includes both livestock and pets. The legislature was also looking at how to adequately fund the department in terms of our wolf recovery and management activities, and the governor recently signed a bill that provided a $10 increase to the personalized license plate. And if you just do the math and don't assume any reduction in the number of people that buy the personalized license plate, as a result of the $10 increase, it would raise something on the order of $1.6 million. There should be a spending plan that has been handed out to you. There, please note at the bottom of that, there are some caveats to it. Those were those activities and the expenditures were our thinking on how to expend those funds. There's also some thinking being done at the legislative branch of government on how at least a portion of those funds should be spent in terms of a research project with Washington State University. And so those discussions are currently ongoing across the street. So there may be a portion of those funds that are directly dedicated to a specific activity that the legislature may deem to be critical. So now I'm going to turn to my catch-all category.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me.
Commissioner Jennings.
Sorry, just one quick question. This is something you've told us before, and I just don't remember. What was the number of breeding pairs where are we with the number of breeding pairs after December?
I believe it's 5 successful breeding pairs. Nate, is that right?
Okay.
Thank you.
5 successful breeding pairs.
Okay.
I don't want you to be distracted. Not that you ever are. So my catch-all category includes an update on a few things. Some of you, maybe all of you, have heard some concerns about our winter range closer, Clockham area, Whiskey Dick. And at least coupled with that in some people's perspective is the work that we did on the Tuckasin Creek and Stray Gulch, and whether or not that work was done in a manner that was consistent with the HPA permit that was issued by the department for that work. And I had an opportunity, I'll call it, to go to that site this week, and it's no easy task to get there. It takes about 3.5 pretty grueling hours from Ellensburg to get there over roads that, and I've done a lot of four-wheeling in my younger day, and the rocks on those roads were comparable to anything I've seen. Normally I would have turned around and gone back and encountered some of those roads myself, but we didn't. So we visited the site. There are several improvements that I think those of us who visited the site thought could be made in terms of providing walkways through some of the road blockages that are meant to keep vehicles from going up along the road. This road is very, very close to Tuckasin Creek, and where the repair work was done is where the road actually was sloughing off into the river. There was an effort to smooth those areas, provide a lot of planting plant life, different kinds of plant life, to secure the site and the hillside, so to keep the sloughing of sediment into the stream. And it also, if you're going to accomplish that, necessitated a closure of a portion of the Tuckasin Road and Stray Gulch. And the closure is one of the issues that's been called into question by some people who like to visit there. We walked up the area and looked at it. And we're going to be compiling a report and a letter that I'll be sending back to Senator Holmquist, who also asked me to come and visit with her about this issue in her office here a couple of weeks ago. The winter range closure, we're making a part of the NANM process. That's a public process. It does a more comprehensive review of the closures, then the issues associated with elk damming on ag lands, and it also gives us the opportunity to bring forth data that we've collected as a result of having that winter range closure for, I think this was the fourth year, I believe, as to whether or not it's achieving the desired outcome and whether or not there's some other way maybe to accomplish reducing, minimizing ag damage from wintering elk. So just a brief, just to let you know that I've paid some particular attention to that, had some great guides from the region with our wildlife area manager and our region program manager from Wildlife, Ted Clausing, as well as some of our Olympia folks joined me in that expedition. Second item, at our last conference call, we talked about the purchase of those two parcels in Stamil. We were anticipating that the Board of Natural Resources would approve that purchase. They did not. It was, I believe, a 4-1 vote, four in favor, one against, and there were a few board members not present. And as a result, they didn't approve that. The one dissenting vote expressed concern about the department and our closure of public lands, and was concerned that I think this stems right back to the winter closure issue that has been, in my view, blown up broader than life, and to suggest that we don't have a high value for public access to lands that we have under our purview of management. And so it's not over. There's going to be some outreach to the individual that was the dissenting vote and to have some further discussions. And so I'm still hopeful that they will at the end of the day approve it, but we'll have to wait to see. We are coming out of another topic, out of the North of Falcon process. We did not reach agreement with the Puyallup tribe relative to our recreational fishery on the Puyallup River. They were requesting a significant number of closure days and an expansion of the area on the river to which those closure days would apply. Finally had an opportunity to go up and meet with the tribal council yesterday. I don't believe any closer to a resolution of those issues than we were before. Pat Patillo and Steve Teasfield and John Long from Fish Program are working on a response, but we'll keep working with that. But we need to get our season date solidified here soon. It will undoubtedly require some additional closure days in September, in particular, in order for us to meet our. In order for us to be below the 50% exploitation rate that's established in the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan for that system. So be prepared for that. How many additional closure days and where those closure days apply, we're working on that. But I'm not sure whether or not the Puyallup Tribal Council will be accepting of our response. And so that all that remains to be seen. Also had an opportunity to meet with John Janey and Kirk Hudson from Chelan PUD yesterday regarding Moses Lake, lake levels. There's a desire of residents around the lake to keep the lake level higher earlier in the year and later in the year than what is currently being done. And so we explored some potential alternatives as to how that might happen. There's been some modeling done relative to flows, power generation that seem to indicate that there's an opportunity, particularly in the fall time frame, to maintain the lake level at a higher level longer into September and even early October. It might require an amendment to the license agreement, though, which comes with its own perils. But we are, I did meet with those folks, and we are working on some ideas about how to better meet the needs of the residents that are surrounding Moses Lake. Almost done. Co-management. I think I've expressed to some of you individually that the status of our co-management relationship with the tribes, I think, is not at a healthy point. And so I've reached out to some of the several tribal leaders, Billy Frank, Ed Johnstone, and talked with them about what we might do, and Lorraine Loomis, to talk with them about what we might do to help reinvigorate the health of co-management. And so I'm going to be meeting with those folks here next week, I think it's next week, and which will eventually have a broader discussion, but just to get some sense of where the problem areas are, what's the cause of those, and what we might be able to do as leaders to help address those, and I say reinvigorate the health of the co-management relationship. And it isn't just with the state and the tribes, it's also intertribally as well. So wanted you to be aware of that. So I did want to take the opportunity to introduce Clay Sprague, who's sitting just behind me off to my left, who's our new division manager for our lands division. Clay comes to us with a wealth of experience, having a long career with the Department of Natural Resources in a, I shouldn't say a similar area of responsibility because I don't know that for certain, but I do know that he has extensive experience in land management, land acquisition, and running and supervising staff that have those responsibilities. So we're really happy to have him with us. I think you also saw that Jim Brown is our new Region 2 regional director. So his kind of first official day on the job was, I think, June 1. And we're obviously working with his supervisor from his previous job as sergeant over in Okanagan County, Captain Chris Anderson, to assure a smooth transition. And we want to make sure we don't leave. He'll leave a hole in the enforcement program, no doubt, but we want to make sure we have a smooth transition there. And you may also have seen, I know some of you did see, that Chief Bruce Bjork has announced his intent to retire in September. Obviously going to leave a huge hole. We're going to be starting very soon on the recruitment process and selection process so that we can try to have someone in that position that's highly qualified a little bit before he leaves is our hope. And I also think it's fair for me to announce that we have a new commissioner, Jay Hosemiller, from Annatone. Annatone is about 15 miles up on the plateau out of Asotin. It's a great little town. It's a very small one. They have a sign as you go in and out of town, which takes you about 10 seconds to ride through there on a motorcycle, that the population of people is whatever it is in the hundreds, low hundreds, and cats are 50 and horses are almost close to the human population. But it's up on kind of a high plateau area before you drop down into the Grand Ronde, dryland wheat country up there. And his effective date is June 10th, so which I believe is Monday. So that brings me to the end of my director's report. Sorry, I ran over a little bit, but again, we'd been away. We had been together for quite a while and needed a little chance to catch up.
Yep, very good. next, and can we defer the budget report perhaps till tomorrow even?
Pretty much. We don't have a lot. Well, we don't have anything to share other than they're working on it over there.
Oh, okay.
We've got a House budget. Hasn't gone over to the Senate. We know there's some differences of opinion about revenue and expenditures, and so we're still monitoring, waiting for a budget.
Okay. Then I'll start with Commissioner Mencken, and I know we are behind schedule now. We want to take a break before the Cabazon item, but I think that there's a lot of questions we would like to ask the director. This is an important part of each commission meeting, so I want to give enough time to that, and maybe there's other items in the agenda that we can shorten up or move so that we give adequate time to the interests of the commission and having a conversation with you. So I'll start with Commissioner Mencken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to the Lower Columbia River and ask a couple of questions. The Fish Committee met last night and discussed it in some length, and Jim Scott briefed us on many of the things that you talked about. It's a complicated issue. I can understand why our constituents are concerned and confused out there, and I think we need to move to explain in some detail, like you have done, what the issue really is in the Lower Columbia River. I think the complication of the issue has led to a lot of speculation on the part of our constituents, and I feel, and the commission or the committee also feels, that we owe them an explanation. What we suggest, and it's up to the commission to, I think, either approve or disapprove of what we have requested, what we're going to request, which is that you take the information that you gave in such detail today and write a letter to the commission explaining exactly what you did today. And the commission would then, I think, make that public, so that you know, our constituents would understand in some detail what exactly is happening. So if the commission is willing, and you, Mr. Director, are also willing, that would, I think, be our preferred approach.
Commissioner Mencken, I'm happy to do that, but frankly, I don't want to wait. I don't want to wait that long, and I will do that in addition to some immediate steps that we want to take. This caught me off guard a little bit, to be honest.
Well, I did the commission as well.
I'm not saying that to be, well, I understand that. The communication with some of the kind of our key stakeholders is what we haven't done that we need to do. I want to get on that right away, and not to say that we can't write a letter right away, but that, to me, I want to get on this right away and communicate with our key stakeholders that were part of the development of the policy and get on that today, Monday. I have a conversation with Heath Heikla, so I want to get on this really, really quickly. All I'm saying is happy to do that, but there's some additional things that I think that with some immediate communication over the phone need to be done.
Yeah, I think the commission would encourage you to do that.
Okay. Did you have any other? Oh, yeah. Commissioner Carpenter, we'll give him a chance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil, my questions, too, I guess, are also on the Columbia River policy. I appreciate what you just said. You spelled out all the issues that the department's had to deal with since January, I guess. During the commission policy adoption of the Columbia River plan, there obviously was a pilot fisheries that were supposed to start initially in 2013. We can't do that for what you already articulated. Could we craft a phase-in schedule so we can have that for our constituents that says in 2014 that the phase-in will be X percent, 2014, 2015, to try and get caught up with what our our commitment was? That's the first question. The second question is, one of the concerns I have going back reading through documents that we got during the work group and then during the adoption process, I have some concerns about the tanglenet release mortality and how we're going to gather more data on that. So I'll just leave it at that for now because I know time's a concern, but how we're going to handle that in the future so we know what we're dealing with.
To response, phase in, I think that is best done. I think we need to get our advisory group established over the course of the next, I'll say, month or so, month to 6 weeks. That advice, those that are required under the Emergency Commercial Fisheries Statute, if we choose to limit the number of participants, which I'm assuming we will want to do. And we need to work with them to develop the phase-in. And so I would look for that as part of one of the work products, that over the course of the time frame of the next, I'm just going to say 6 months, just because that's my best guess, is that we would have a plan, an implementation plan, which would include the phase-in pieces developed so that there would be a solid understanding of what we would be doing in 2014. So that's how I would think about doing that. The TangleNet piece, I understand that there's been some concerns about the release mortality rate. You know, we've put a fair amount of work into studying that and analyzing it, having it reviewed by external scientists, experts. I'm happy to have a conversation with Jim Scott about that as to whether or not what additional work may be done. We are, and I will say that the pilot program in 13, we are doing the COHO pilot program part of this. So we're not, I don't think we're not having any kind of an implementation of the pilot program that's specified in the policy. We're doing that on COHO. But and the reason we're able to do it with COHO is that we're doing it with tangle nets, where we don't have the same problem with Oregon and the litigation and the lack of it being illegal gear that we do with purslane and betaine. So on the components that we're able to move forward on, we're doing that. And of course, you also are aware that we've, on the summer Chinook allocation piece, again, there's a difference of policy, and we're going to the middle of that, so we're making some progress in terms of implementation of the policy in the summer fishery. But I will have a conversation regarding the tanglenet release mortality. I think there's some work planned. I'm hesitant to say this on the record, but for the coho tanglenet fishery, as part of that is looking at release mortality. I'll have to confirm that to ensure that I'm correct about that.
Thank you. I think I'm just trying to prepare a little bit for constituent criticism and be prepared to try and share the what's and why's and what the future is. That was my rationale for the questions.
Commissioner Perry was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask questions on, comment at least on a couple of issues. The little town of Annatone, I think, has less than 100 people currently. They've had more, but it's gone down. A I'm really glad you got an introduction to the road closure, land closure issue in Central Washington. It's simply gotten out of hand. And it seems like there's two sides. There's the Ellensburg side and the Wenatchee side. The Wenatchee side being more or less for these closures and so forth, the Ellensburg side being adamantly against it, 100% of any closure of any kind. And there doesn't seem to be any resolution of that problem, at least I haven't seen it. I get many more calls from Ellensburg than I do Wenatchee. And, boy, those people are unhappy. I guess I don't... trying to think how to say this. I guess I'll be brief. This is a symptom of, I think, what's happening in a broader sense over the state of Washington. Department of Fish and Wildlife lands are purchased and managed for, number one, enhancement of fish and wildlife, and number two, for recreation. And I think that's a distinction that needs to be made. Recreation and adequate use or best use of wildlife habitat are not necessarily compatible. And I think we need to recognize that. The second part is that Department of Fish and Wildlife lands used to just blend into the landscape and not be very well recognized anymore. With the build-out in Washington, the increase in agriculture, roads, businesses, department lands are standing out more and more. You can see them on the landscape. We have a lot more publications that denote department land, and we have relatively few restrictions on what you can do out there. And I think this is becoming recognized by the public with the increase in use of ATV-type vehicles that can literally go anywhere without exception. Having some control of that recreation on department lands is becoming more difficult all the time, and I think this road issue is bringing it into sharp focus. It's going to become more of an issue in the future, but I think we have to, as a department, look out for the long-term maintenance of fish and wildlife, and that's going to be result in some restrictions in our land. I don't see how you can help it. The damage problem, the Clockham area that we're talking about has it all. It has a damage problem that I think the restriction of public use of those lands during at least some portion of the year can help a lot. How we're going to solve this issue in Central Washington, I think to some degree is going to take some education. I know the people that I've talked to simply understand that the department wants to close all their lands and keep everybody off. Well, that's simply not the case. And the road closures that have been proposed or the seasonal closures of particular landscapes are for a specific wildlife purpose. And whether it be calving or reducing some of the impact of shed hunting or things like that, I think we need to look out for the resource first, recreation second. I could talk a long time on that. I'll just sort of leave it at that. But I think more education on why we're looking at road closures and the fact we're not trying to keep public out, those areas will be open for significant portions of the year. Any road closures will be to maintain good habitat, and there will still be public access into those areas. I think that needs to be promoted a lot more than it has in the past, or rather than the public perceive that it's just simply a blanket closure of our lands. The second thing would be the wolf collaring. I appreciate the presentation on that, and the fact we've got four teams now, I think, is really positive. I would like to have the department encourage those people to be out there a lot. Collaring is really about the only way we can keep track of those packs that are out there and the new ones that are being established, and to determine whether there is reproduction each year, whether it's a breeding pair. I think it's really critical to have collars on there to be able to get that information. The other thing I am really concerned about is the ability to determine whether there's actually breeding pairs out there. And it seems like the wolves, using Idaho as an example, just have expanded in a geometric fashion, and even they have difficulty determining breeding pairs, and their estimates are a third to a half of the packs are breeding, which doesn't really make any sense when you look at the amount of expansion of the wolf population in a state like Idaho, and I don't think Washington is going to be any different. We've got to somehow get a better handle on how to determine breeding pairs, because it doesn't, the amount of increase in wolves and the number of breeding pairs and the offspring that we find don't jive. I get that from people all the time, and I'd just like to have a little more information. We can probably discuss that in the Wildlife Committee a little bit. I'll just leave those issues there.
Director Anderson?
Just a brief response to Commissioner Perry's first point. I did go over to Ellensburg and meet with the president of the Kittitas Field and Stream, Deborah Essman, and Jim Huckabee, who's, I don't know if Jim's on their board, but he's an active member. Nate and I went over and spent a couple hours with him 2.5 weeks ago, and just understanding that we just have some really difficult issues, and they're certainly, as you accurately represent, they're not happy with us. And we talked about, you know, what we could do to, where there's some areas that we could work on positive things. Nate's got some pretty exciting things going on with the potential of developing some shooting ranges, getting some partnership with the NRA that he met with an official from back east from that organization this week. So I think there are some things that we can do. I think the NANM process hopefully can get us to, I don't know that it's not going to make everybody happy. There isn't anything we're going to, but at the same time, you know, Commissioner Perry, just making sure that people understand the purpose of where we do have our lands closed for a particular point, a period of time, why that is and what we're trying to accomplish. Because clearly there was not a common understanding or of the reason behind the winter closure on the Clackam. So anyway, we're working on that, but you're right. We've got a long ways to go.
Okay. Commissioner Caney was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. First, I'd just like to commend Donnie for doing what he said he'd do and getting the GPS data and telemetry information up and running by June 1, which was just amazing, and it's a great tool. I've had a chance to look at it in the field. And I think it's extremely valuable, especially in the ranchers' hands that are dealing with wolves affecting and moving around their livestock herds. It helps them understand wolf behavior, and I think that's one of the most important things. It puts us, I believe, light years ahead of Idaho, Montana, other states, other places that have dealt with wolves. We are just on the leading edge of the technology. You know, there's still a human factor, and there's human behavior, and understanding how wolf behavior affects cattle behavior and how that can affect a change. But it's just outstanding. And anybody that could get a chance to see how that works should on the commission, because it's just so valuable. You'll also note, as soon as you see that in those pictures, if you do like a three-week search of where the wolf, collared wolf, has been moving, within an instant you know where the den is, just that fast. You just look at the map and you know. So I'm a little curious, and I know the reasons for furnishing the data to county, and it's going to build partnerships, and it's about data sharing, but there's pretty strict parameters on what the rancher can do with that data. And I'm just curious more about the sideboards with the commissioners and the counties getting the data, because where does it go from there? Does it go to the sheriff's department? Does it, you know, is there something that's going to keep that a little bit held in so it just doesn't get out to the whole general public? In terms of protecting that resource, the wolf den locations. And I didn't see that in the agreement, so I'm just curious where we're at on that.
I don't have a, thank you, Commissioner Keeney. I don't have a copy of the data sharing agreements, the data share agreements that we have developed with the counties with me. So I'm happy to get you one. And I also know that we've shared agreements with 10 counties. I think that's what they're telling me is we've, it doesn't mean we've entered into agreements with 10 counties. It means we've offered to 10 counties that if they would like to enter into an agreement with us with data sharing, understanding what those parameters are in terms of how that data is shared is, I'm sure, what's in that data sharing agreement. So I can't answer your question specifically. I'd be happy to get you a copy of the data sharing agreement that we're asking the counties to sign before we provide the data to them.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I have first just a comment, and then secondly a question. I want to thank Commissioner Perry for stating his views so eloquently on the use of department lands. I wish I could have done that. I subscribe to exactly what he says, and that shows the value of him to this commission. Now my question. It deals with the purchase of the two sections in the Stemelt Basin and that not being approved by DNR. Obviously, I'm very disappointed. It was the subject of a special commission phone conference call a week ago, which there was agreement to do this. My biggest concern, and I'd like to know more of the risk, is that we stand to lose the funding that we had set aside for this. So that's a part of the question, Phil. And then secondly, should this all fall apart, do we still have the 50-year lease in place? Which to me is part of the reason that DNR should want to negotiate.
We still have an opportunity to secure the sale with approval from Department of Natural Resources before the end of the biennium, and we lose the opportunity to use that trust land transfer funding for that purpose. It's tight, I think I can speak with confidence that Commissioner Goldmark is committed to try to make this happen. Clay Sprague is our land division manager, is working with his counterpart in the Department of Natural Resources and communicating with the dissenting vote on the board to try to make sure he understands what we do in terms of providing public access on our lands, because, well, it seems clear to me that someone has misrepresented what we do. So there's still time. We're working on making that happen. That we do have, as you correctly noted, 50-year leases on those four parcels. And if this doesn't go through, we still have those leases. They're not. We haven't withdrawn from those leases. We would withdraw from two of the leases if the sale goes through. And then the last topic that you had raised on the conference call, there was a concern about the use, at least of one of those parcels, that might be more applicable to leasing for orchards development, and a concern about requiring an individual who did that to ensure that they put up the proper fences so that we didn't run into an elk damage issue. And I've passed around a letter that I received from Commissioner Goldmark as a result of my request of him to provide us assurances that that would be accomplished in the event that some portion of that property was leased to someone for orchard development.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, can I just say how much I appreciate the director's actions? You know, this is, took one day to make this happen, and to me, it makes me an absolute firm believer in the need for this land, because we've protected ourselves. Our future investment in fencing would have fallen on our shoulders had not the director taken care of that. So thank you, Phil.
We are running a bit late, but we do want to take a break before we take up the Cabazon briefing, hearing, and decision. So let's reconvene at 10:30, give ourselves almost 15 minutes.